Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, where each week we delve into little-known healthcare and hospital hazards, as well as other fringe topics that affect your health and well-being. I'm so happy you've taken the time to join me, and today I have lots to share with you. So, let's dig right in, shall we? Always bringing you guests with an eye on topics seldom discussed on mainstream media, and today's special guest fits the bill. He is Professor Paul Conant, a graduate of Cambridge University who also holds a PhD in chemistry from Dartmouth College. In May 2006, he retired from his full professorship in chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, where he taught for 23 years and specialized in environmental chemistry and toxicology. Paul has researched the literature on fluoride's toxicity and the fluoridation debate for 18 years, and he helped found the Fluoride Action Network, and you can find them online at fluoridealert.org. He has given invited presentations on the dangers of fluoridation to legislative and research bodies and local communities in Australia, Canada, Germany, Ireland, Israel, Japan, New Zealand, the UK, and the United States. This has included invited presentations in 2003 to both the EPA, the US EPA, and the US National Research Council. In 2010, with two other authors, he published the book, The Case Against Fluoride, which contains 80 pages of citations to the scientific literature. And as of June 2014, there is yet to be a scientifically referenced response to this book. Well, there's lots to talk about, so welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Pat. Happy to be on it.
Oh, pleasure is all ours. Well, listen, everybody listening has heard about fluoride. It's in our toothpaste. Dentists give us the fluoride rinse. It's in our waters. What is it that causes you to have concern?
It's a very toxic substance, number one. Number two, nature gave her own verdict on this. And I want to make especially stress this, because often the other side will say fluoride is natural, it occurs naturally in some water supplies, it's in the sea, etc. All of which is correct, but misses the point. Whether or not a substance is in the water is a vagary of geology. It's where the water has flown through before it ends up in your well or in the groundwater. So that's a function of geology. A function of nature, nature's verdict on whether a baby should get fluoride is the level in mother's milk. And that was the shock for me 18 years ago, was to find how low the level is in mother's milk. It's 0.004 parts per million. And so before people get confused about the units, 0.004 parts per million is about 250 times less than what we add to the drinking water. It's about one part per million. So basically that means that today in America, a bottle-fed baby in a fluoridated community, which is most of the communities, will be getting 250 times more fluoride than nature intended. And that, to me, is a reckless thing to do. The whole notion that a group of dentists who have no toxicological training whatsoever know more about what the baby should get than nature herself is absolutely preposterous. Yes. And yet, you think about evolution. Think about what it's taken from the primeval slurp to the baby, millions of years of evolution. There wasn't a restriction on nature for fluoride. As I said, there's plenty in the sea. The average level in the sea is about 1.3, 1.4 parts per million. So as life was evolving, there was no restriction. Nature could have used fluoride in the mainstream of biology if she had wanted to. But today we find there's not one single biochemical process in the human body that needs fluoride. fluoride. And yet we do know that there are many processes in the body which are harmed by fluoride. Enzymes are inhibited by fluoride. G proteins are switched on by fluoride. Fluoride may cause oxidative stress, all kinds of problems. And yet, no benefit. Nobody has ever shown that fluoride is an essential nutrient, which would be a surprise in the context of what I already said about the level in mother's milk. That suggests that it's not a nutrient, because if it was a nutrient, why would nature not give it to the baby in the baby's first meal? When the baby is developing, all its systems are developing. If fluoride was necessary, that's where you'd expect to find it. But it's not there, or certainly not there in any significant level at all.
What a great way to begin this conversation. I've never known that, and I think that's just mind-blowing that, yeah, nature pretty much solves all problems if we pay attention and allow her to do so. And fluoride is the only chemical that I guess I know of that's added to water that doesn't actually treat the water.
That's a very good point. And I would say that's the second most important point, because there are reasons for that. We've never used the public water supply since fluoridation began in 1945. We haven't used this as a precedent to use the public water supply to deliver any other form of human treatment, medical treatment, nothing else. And the reason for that is pretty obvious, because once you use the public water supply as a delivery system, once you put this chemical in the water, you can't control the dose.
Right.
Because you can't control how much water people drink. You can't control who it goes to, because it goes to every human being, whether they're sick, whether they're poor nourished, whether they're very young, they're very old, and so on and so on and so on. And thirdly, using the water supply like this, you're taking away the individual's right to informed consent to medication. And to put that more starkly, when a community fluoridates, the community is doing to everyone what an individual doctor could do to no one in that community, force them to take a medication against their will.
Absolutely. So what you're saying is that the fluoridation can basically add a prescription strength dose of drug to the water supply, and then we've got this forced masked medication aspect, almost similar to something we talk about all the time, is the forced deployment of smart meters. And as a society, we simply should not be forced to ingest or be bathed in any kind of frequencies against anything, against our knowledge or will. So
yes, indeed. In fact, you know, we live in the land of the free, except certain freedoms are very much restricted here in the United States. And we have to question that. So every time you see freedom restricted. But there are many threats to our freedom, I think, here in the United States, which you see with fluoride. I think the whole notion that we can't any longer trust our health agencies on this particular issue, maybe other issues as well. But I think it's very sad and very serious when we now know that organizations like the FDA, the EPA, the CDC are not using honest or the best science on this issue to protect the people, which is what they're supposed to be doing. And we are finding another threat to our freedom is when the press doesn't do a decent job. We don't have many investigative journalists left in the United States, and those that are left very seldom do an in-depth treatment of this issue. We don't get both sides aired with some kind of comprehensiveness. We get the so-called two sides of a story that appears umpteen times in our newspapers. It goes something like this. The Center for Disease Control says that fluoridation is one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. And now we're going to do our journalistic duty and give the other side. Mrs. Clutterbuck down the street thinks it's a bad idea. and from that, now the journalists have satisfied the need to quote from both sides, and we can continue at this ghastly superficial level, which is self-serving as far as the interests of establishing that two things. One is that authority says that fluoridation is safe and effective, which we get from a list of endorsements, which actually, when you look into them, are pretty meaningless and pretty shallow. And the opponents of fluoridation, who are meant to be the Flat Earth Society, Looney Tunes, flaky, you can continue the way they denigrate opponents today, and they've been doing that for 60 or 70 years. But all of this appeal to authority on the one hand and denigrating opponents, on the other hand, serves the interest of keeping the public, the media, and decision makers away from the science. Because the science says emphatically that swallowing fluoride does little to reduce tooth decay. They've never done a randomized controlled trial, which is what the FDA requires for any other drug, to establish effectiveness. And so that's one of the reasons, because the FDA has never regulated fluoride for ingestion. In all the years of fluoridation, it's never looked at fluoride as another drug to be regulated. It hasn't done its job here. So I'm afraid it's a pretty sad story all the way around.
I agree. I'm going to talk about tooth decay in a moment, but I want to go back to something you said about the government agencies such as the CDC and the FDA looking out for us. It's sad that most folks don't know that these are really corporations. I mean, they're listed on Dun and Bradstreet, and the only reason why they would be a corporation is for profit reasons. So I think to think going out of the gate that they're going to be looking after our well-being is probably short-sighted. And secondly, you talked about the media. Well, most of the media is corporate-owned, and so again, as you said, we're only going to hear what they want us to hear and not necessarily what science will support.
It drives me up the wall when you get the issue raised in certain communities. You'll get the powerful dental lobby behind the scenes nobbling the local editor of usually quite an influential newspaper in the area. And very quickly, they will come out with a really vicious editorial, chastising the politicians for being so anti-science and listening to these crackpots who want to destroy the health and the teeth of our children, and presenting the opponents of fluoridation as being anti-scientific and getting away with it, and people believing this.
Yes.
Now, you contrast that with the reality. The reality is, and you mentioned at the beginning, three scientists, myself, a retired chemist, James Beck, an MD and retired physicist, and Spedding Micklem, a retired biologist who got his Doctor of Philosophy from Oxford, taught at Edinburgh University. The three of us retired professors had plenty of time to review this issue and come up with a book, 380 pages. And as you said, every single argument in that book is documented with citations to the scientific literature, 80 pages of references in all. And in the 4 years or so since that book was published, there's never been a comprehensive scientific rebuttal of this book. So for these little tinpot editor writers who may know something about bicycles, but they certainly don't know anything about science, ridiculing opponents in the most vicious way when their side cannot debate us in public. I haven't mentioned that yet. They refuse to debate us in public one-on-one, two-on-two, to demonstrate the superiority of their views. So on the one hand, they duck the debates. On the other hand, when they were asked to do this in writing, they can't do it. Let me give you a good example, Pat, because to me this was very illustrative. Shortly after we published our book in October of 2010, I was in New Zealand, and the citizens organized a meeting with the Ministry of Health, which is very pro-fluoridation. I went to give my presentation, their PowerPoint presentation, based upon the book. And about 20 people showed up, which was a surprise. I was only expecting two or three bureaucrats, but about 20 people showed up. Anyway, I went through all the arguments in the PowerPoint, carefully documenting everything, and I got to the end. I said, look, we three scientists have done everything that you could expect from opponents of a particular practice. We've made our arguments completely transparent. We've backed up all the science with references to the literature. We've done our job. Now your job. You're an agency that promotes fluoridation. You should be able to take our book and critique it page by page, chapter and chapter, and to demonstrate that we are wrong. And I am expecting a written response to this book.
Oh.
And in 4 years, they produce nothing,
nothing,
nada, nothing, no attempt whatsoever to respond to the arguments in that book. Meanwhile, a few months ago, the Minister of Health, the head of this agency, goes on television and chastises the opponents of fluoridation for misusing the literature. And yet, in his staff, he couldn't muster anybody to give a scientific response to our scientific argument. And that does make you pretty angry after a while.
It makes you angry, and it also begs the question, why? I mean, what drives this community to hold on to this myth? I even saw that you said on your website that the American Dental Association is so concerned about you, apparently, that they deemed it necessary to purchase the domain fluoridealert.com instead of yours.org so that people might mistakenly go to theirs.
It's quietly unethical.
Yeah, I mean, so my question is, what drives the community to hold on to this myth? What is the point?
Well, I think it's a mixture of things. Obviously, there are economic interests involved. There are liabilities involved. Don't forget the ADA has its seal of approval on all the fluoride dental products. And so if fluoridation falls, it's going to put a question mark on the safety of all these fluoridated dental products. And then when the lawsuits ensue, the dental product manufacturers are going to call upon the ADA or point the finger at the ADA, and they might too have liabilities because of all these endorsement of the products. There are also many industries that use fluoride and expose their workers to fluoride at much higher levels than we get in the water. And they too have concern about liabilities. If fluoridation was to fall, what does it say about the safety of their workers that they've exposed to for much larger quantities of fluoride? I'm thinking particularly of the workers in the aluminum industry, where if they work in the pot lines, they get exposed to a lot of fluoride dust and fluoride fumes from the process for extracting aluminum, which uses cryolite, which contains fluoride, and calcium fluoride as a flux in the system. So there are economic liabilities involved. There's a phosphate fertilizer industry that supplies the chemicals, the hazardous waste byproducts from the processing of phosphate rock. They too, they're making a lot of money, avoiding sending this to a hazardous waste facility and also being paid by utilities for the use of this chemical. So they stand to lose a lot of money. There's a different reason that comes in, and it's an old one. It's the fear of bureaucrats to admit they're wrong. It's the notion that policy is king. If you work in a bureaucracy, you don't challenge policy without risking your future. So your job as a bureaucrat is to carry out policy, to promote policy, and if you don't, you're suspect. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the policy is this long-standing policy going on for 68 years now in the United States. And so you've got this whole chain of command from the Department of Health and Human Services, of which CDC is one part. And by the way, the only people in the CDC involved with fluoridation is the Oral Health Division. And that's only 30 people. And most of those, if they've got any training at all, are dentally trained. No toxicologist, no specialist in medicine. These are the ones who promote fluoridation. And they're out of date with the actual health studies, but their job is to promote it. They have a conflict of interest. So when you hear the CDC says it's one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century, they've been promoting it.
Right.
For most of
at least
half of the 20th century, their job has been to promote it. So why would they say anything else? So I think their fear that the public health community, which includes, incidentally, the American Public Health Association. Public health is a strange creature compared to individual health practices. If you go to a doctor, he or she chooses the medicine based upon you, your susceptibilities, and he will do a little trial and error. He'll give you a medicine, see if it works, see if you have side effects. He might tinker around with the dose. He may even drop the drug if it doesn't work, and so on. Whereas you've got this public health is indiscriminate. It says this is something we're going to do to everyone. We can't control the dose. We have no oversight of what happens to individuals, and it's all part of the greater good. I mean, they satisfy themselves with the notion that yes, a few people will be harmed, but the larger number of people will have a benefit. So that works for them. But that's where the individual choice should come in. The individual should make a decision based upon balancing the risks with the benefits. That's an individual decision. It should never be, in my view, a government decision to balance those risks and benefits for you, to say some people will be harmed, other people won't be harmed. And today that's reached fairly massive proportion.
Yes.
Because now at least 41% of American kids have dental fluorosis, mm-hmm. one of the undenied harms of fluoride exposure when you're young, before your permanent teeth have erupted, is damage to the enamel called dental fluorosis. And when they began, the trade-off was 10% of the kids would get this in very mild form. Now it's up to 41%, and that's an average of kids living in fluoridated, non-fluoridated communities. Anyway, to get back to my point, sorry, that was a long discussion there, but I think the fear with the public health community is losing the public's trust. If they admit that they've been wrong on fluoridation, which they promoted and waxed lyrical about for decades, if they admit that they're wrong, then I think they fear that they're going to lose the public's trust in other public health practices.
Right.
And that's when you get to something pretty serious. I don't think that fluoridation is worth a hill of beans. It's a fraction of a tooth decay at best that you may be saving. The average kid might have a saving of less than one tooth surface for a lifelong exposure to fluoride, or at least his childhood exposure to fluoride. It's not worth a hill of beans. It's certainly not worth risking their bones, their brains, and so on. But if they are defending other public health practices by proxy because they don't want to get this credibility hit, then you get into vaccination. And vaccination is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's clearly collusion between the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry. We have more lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry in Washington, D.C. than congressmen. And yes, they've got the giveaway there. They've told the vaccine manufacturers remove liability from them. The government takes the liability for these vaccines. So clearly, if they were to say that fluoridation is actually wrong after telling us it's right, then they're fearful that this could sabotage their precious vaccination program. And I don't say that because I'm an opponent of vaccination. I'm not. I question how many vaccines are being given to babies. I certainly question the use of organic mercury. But I'm not out there campaigning against vaccination per se, but I can see it from their perspective. They don't want to have any hits on vaccination. That's big money for them.
Absolutely. I am so glad you brought that up. We've had several segments on vaccines and mandatory vaccines, and it's interesting that you're bringing this connection between fluoride and vaccines. So tooth decay and fluoride, there's really not a connection there. I mean, as you're saying, it's not going to save very many teeth by fluoridating the...
The ironic thing is that in 1999, the Center of Disease Control that promotes this practice in the United States admitted what many dental researchers have been finding for the previous 20 years, that the main benefit of fluoride is topical. It works, as far as the benefits are concerned. If it works at all, it works on the outside of the tooth enamel, hardens the outside of the tooth enamel, makes it more resistant to the acid attack, and the acids are coming from bacteria broken, the sugar broken down by bacteria. And they used to think that the baby had to swallow this, the pregnant mother had to take fluoride tablets to get this fluoride into the enamel of the developing teeth, under the gums, so when the teeth erupted, they would be more protected against tooth decay. And then in 1999, the CDC said, whoops, the epidemiological studies, the biochemical studies show that that is not the mechanism. There's very little benefit from the systemic involvement, the internal exposure to fluoride before the teeth have erupted. Most of the benefit comes topically. Well, the moment they admitted that, that should have been the end of fluoridation.
Right
there. Because if it works topically, topical treatments are universally available in the form of fluoridated toothpaste. If you want fluoride, it's out there. Brush it on your teeth, spit it out. In 18 years, I haven't used fluoridated toothpaste. But if you want fluoride, I don't want another drop, microgram of fluoride in my body, thank you. But if you do want it, brush it on your teeth and spit it out. And this way, if you use that approach, not only do you protect most of the tissues in your body from the exposure to fluoride from drinking water, but you don't force it on people that don't want it. So you solve both the medical problems and the ethical problems in one simple stroke. Accept the mechanism offered by the proponents that it works topically, use topical treatments, and stop forcing it on us via our drinking water every day.
Yep. I've read that there's more people drinking fluoridated water in the United States than the rest of the world, yet there's no difference in tooth decay between Western nations that fluoridate their water and those that do not. So what's up with that?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a shock for some people. Some people that when they, first of all, 97% of Europe does not fluoridate its water. A few of those countries that are not fluoridate their salt, but even they are in the minority. So the minority of European countries fluoridate their salt and their water, but the majority fluoridate neither. And yet, according to World Health Organization data, for 12-year-olds, the tooth decay has been coming down as fast, if not faster, in these non-fluoridated countries as in the fluoridated ones. And if you look at the levels of tooth decay today, it's a wash. You can't tell whether that 12-year-old has grown up in a country like Australia or New Zealand, which are fluoridated, or grown up in a country like Denmark or the Netherlands or Belgium or any of the other non-fluoridated countries. So there are actually better ways of protecting teeth. Scotland, for example, does not have water fluoridation, but they have a Child Smile program there which puts an emphasis on education, early education, teaching kids in primary school, in nursery school, the youngest kids possible, teach them how to brush their teeth, give them decent food during their school days, and teach them and their parents these same things, better dental hygiene and a better diet, reducing sugar consumption, more fruit and vegetables, annual inspections, and topical treatments when they're necessary, including varnishes. And that program has proved very cost effective. It's halved the cost of treating tooth decay in Scotland, and they are over their goal. Their goal, I think, was 70% of children caries free, 10 to 12 year olds key caries free by 2015, and they're up to 73% in 2013, I think. So a very successful program. Instead of the CDC frittering away US taxpayers' money with promotion and propaganda on fluoridation, and all the money that's frittered away on chemicals and engineering to deliver fluoride to the drinking water, put that money into finding what these non-fluoridated countries have done to reduce tooth decay in a safe and cost-effective way.
Right. Logical answer. So we're getting fluoride from our toothpaste, those kind of products. We're getting it from our water sources. What other sources will we find and ingest the most fluoride from?
Well, there's in agriculture particularly, a lot of pesticides contain fluoride. Mm-hmm. Some natural pesticides like cryolite contain fluoride. Fertilizers, particularly phosphate rock, the phosphate that we use in fertilizers contains fluoride as an impurity, as a contaminant. And so we're getting fluoride in fertilizers. And then we've got a horrendous fumigant used on food, used by Dow Chemical, called sulfural fluoride. And then when that hits the food, it's broken down to fluoride. So that's leaving fluoride residues on all our foodstuffs in warehouses and processing plants. So processed foods are allowed up to, I think, 130 parts per million. Wheat flour, which is in everything from cookies to cakes to bread to pizza, that's allowed 130 parts per million. And would you believe powdered eggs, which a third of the eggs consumed in the United States are in the powdered form, that's allowed up to 900 parts per million from this wretched sulfural fluoride fumigant. And to put that into perspective, toothpaste, which you're told do not swallow and only use a pea-sized amount. Mm-hmm. And if you should consume more than the recommended amount, contact the Poison Control Center. That's on the back of every tube of toothpaste in America. Toothpaste is 1,000 parts per million. Only use a pea-sized amount. And if you swallow it, contact the Poison Control Center. Well, you use more than a pea-sized amount of powdered eggs when you're making an omelet or a cake.
Oh.
So, of course, if they were here, they'd say, "Oh, well, that's the maximum you're allowed." And over the year, the average level in powdered eggs would come down considerably. It would be much lower than that. We're protecting against the maximum amount of any batch that's produced. Well, okay. So, supposing you produce a batch of powdered eggs and send that to a hospital or a university or an army barracks where often these institutes use powdered eggs, there's going to be a group of people that get the highest dose all of a sudden. And in that case, kids will be vomiting in their schools if they ate an omelet made with two or three eggs at that level. Equivalent.
Wow. I'm sure our listeners have not given this any thought, huh?
Well, that's the problem. The problem is we that know the science are appalled and staggered. But We are just, without the help of the media and without the help of decision makers who are prepared to do their homework, and the general getting down on their knees and accepting professional bodies at their face value, without that questioning of the science, we are getting truly walloped here. It's very, very difficult. We're winning. I mean, we're many communities. We've got about 130 communities have stopped fluoridation in Canada, the United States, New Zealand, Australia over the last few years. The new Minister of Health in Israel has stopped mandatory fluoridation. Well, will we be stopped as of August this year? So, yes, we're getting some victories, but still the average person out there, when they hear the word fluoride, say, oh, that's good for our teeth. That's good for children. Nothing could be further from the truth. You don't want your children swallowing fluoride. You certainly don't want your babies swallowing fluoride. And to get to the really the most important issue, we now have 37 studies which show an association between lowered IQ and exposure to fluoride in children. The exposure levels are not that high. I mean, we have studies in China down to levels like between 1.2 or 1.5 parts per million where you're seeing lowered IQ, which leaves no margin of safety if you're swallowing fluoride at between 0.7 and 1.2, as in the United States. And it's worse than that because these studies in China, the kids were probably not using fluoridated toothpaste and the babies were probably not being bottle fed. So there are sources of fluoride in America which are higher for American children than those Chinese children. So we have a serious problem here. We may be shifting downwards the IQ of the American public. And to show how pernicious this is, the most emotive argument used by the promoters of fluoridation is that we're having to do this for poor children because 80% of dentists don't treat children on Medicaid. Dentists don't want to treat kids by and large. They're too difficult, and certainly not poor kids. And so to make up for this, to convince the public that we really care about poor kids, we're going to put this poison in the drinking water. But what makes that so pernicious? I mean, it's certainly rational in the sense that, yes, most of the tooth decay, perhaps 80% of the tooth decay, is concentrated in about 20% of the kids who are in from low-income families. But to focus on low-income families is the worst thing we can do because those children are going to be more vulnerable to fluoride because fluoride's toxicity is worse for kids with poor nutrition. Mm-hmm. If they've got low protein, low calcium, low magnesium, low vitamins, they're going to be more vulnerable to fluoride toxicity. So if we're talking about low-income families, those children already have several strikes against them.
Yes.
As far as mental development, IQ is concerned, and diet is concerned. So to focus on them and give them fluoride is the worst thing that we could do. It's the most inequitable thing we can do. And add to that the fact that their parents won't be able to afford the avoidance measures of reverse osmosis or bottled water that middle-income families may be able to afford, even though it's a gross imposition on them to have to do so.
Wow, that's huge. To think about the little developing brain that's harmed by fluoride toxicity, and then, as you say, you've got these underserved families. And, you know, all of us, whether we're underserved, not underserved, we're all being bombarded by, again, you know, genetically modified foods, all the radiation given off by cell phone towers that are everywhere. I mean, you hardly stand a chance, especially these little tiny brains. And I also noticed that your website has a chart of fluoride and health effects from things that people don't think about, from gastrointestinal effects to brain effects, arthritis, diabetes, male fertility. I'm sure folks haven't given that much thought.
No, there's so many tissues that can be impacted because it is a protoplasmic a poison. It's striking at the heart of biology. When it strikes at enzymes and G proteins, they don't expect it just to be focused on one tissue. And the whole notion that somehow it could damage the growing tooth enamel, the growing tooth cells, without damaging other cells in the baby's developing body, like the bone cells. I mean, the teeth grow out of the bone.
Sure.
So if you're loading up the teeth, you've already loaded up the bones with fluoride. Yeah. And also, of course, the other sensitive tissues of the baby's body. And there's some evidence that the baby's blood-brain barrier is not fully developed at birth. So It's every reason to keep fluoride away from the baby. And please, going back to square one, listen to what Mother Nature says. Mom knows best. Mother knows best. Nature, Mother Nature did not put much fluoride in mother's milk. It's the height of arrogance to ignore that message from nature, and we're paying the price of it now.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Are there any symptoms we should equate with too much fluoride?
Well, the kind of symptoms that the most sensitive people, maybe 1% of the population, have to fluoride, it's problematic because there are many causes for these symptoms, like headaches and rashes. You know, people particularly get white spots around the mouth when they're sensitive to fluoride because of that fluoridated toothpaste. Nausea, feeling it impacts the gastrointestinal tract. Nausea, feeling of bloating, irritable brow syndrome, maybe skin rashes I mentioned. A lot of vague symptoms, and there are many individuals out there when they eventually find out that this may be caused by fluoride and avoid fluoride by not drinking the water or what have you, not using fluoridated toothpaste, these symptoms magically clear up.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the fluoride is reintroduced, those symptoms come back. They are convinced. But no government that fluoridates has ever attempted to take these citizens and subject them to blind trials, scientific trials administered by the government. Never bothered to do this. Totally irresponsible from the point of view. It's their practice. They should at least be making sure that people are not being harmed by their practice. But quite frankly, they're putting more money into promoting this practice than investigating the possible harms that it may be causing. In fact, they're not doing the most basic things that you would anticipate. You would anticipate that we would be tracking the level of fluoride in people's bones, because at least 50%, about 50% of the fluoride that we take in each day accumulates in the bones. The kidney does an heroic job of getting rid of about 40 or 50% of the fluoride each day. The rest accumulates in the bones. We're not tracking to see what the bone levels are of fluoride in the United States in communities that are fluoridated. You know, how much fluoride do you have in your bones if you live 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50, 60 years in a fluoridated community? We don't know. We're not doing the tests. Similarly, we're not tracking the fluoride in people's urine. Doctors do not use this as a standard test at all. The doctors are not taught about fluoride's toxicity at medical school. They're only told one side of the story, that fluoridation is the best thing since sliced bread. And similarly in dental schools, dentists are coming out of dental school with only one side of the story, believing the gospel, believing that the people opposed to fluoridation are Looney Tunes. They are taught to roll their eyes when the word fluoridation is mentioned by a patient. And of course, once they've graduated, they don't have time in their busy practices to read the literature. Like I mentioned, the two other scientists myself who wrote this book, we were retired professors. We have plenty of time to read all the literature.
Mm-hmm.
Most dentists and most doctors don't. So I don't hold it against them.
Right, right.
I do hold it against the heads of the professional bodies that they continue to spout this nonsense when they could be getting independent experts to review the literature for them before they make these pronouncements. But they started to make these endorsements on fluoridation in 1950, only after the U.S. Public Health Service told them that fluoridation was safe and effective in 1950. That was before any trial, Pat, had been finished, before there were any published health studies of any significance, and yet the government is declaring it safe and effective. I mean, that's politics, not science, because they didn't have the science. But lock, stop, in comes the American Dental Association, the American Public Health Association, the American Medical Association, all the dental authorities, the territorial state dental directors, all came in like little clockwork toys. After the big boss says it's okay, all the little bosses said it was okay. And that has been perpetuated for 60-odd years. And some of these professional bodies that are trouted, you know, brought out as being endorsers of fluoridation, haven't reviewed this literature for over 50 years. So it's a betrayal of the public's trust. I can't underline that enough. This whole thing from top to bottom is a betrayal of the public's trust. And the only people that can break through this Well, we've got a handful of doctors and dentists who are out there publicly. They risk their prestige, they risk their pressure from their peer reviews, and even in some cases being fired for raising the issue. There are some heroes out there, like Dr. Hardy Lineback in Canada, Dr. David Kennedy in San Diego, Dr. Bill Osmondson in Washington, Dr. John Cahoon, the late Dr. Principal Dental Officer of Auckland, New Zealand. These are all heroes that have come out against this practice, even though once upon a time they promoted it. But by and large, as I said before, in the two chains of command, from the ADA down through the dental associations, down to the local district health, dental body, to from the CDC down to the state health department, state dental directors, down to the local district health boards, these are chains of command. Nobody in the middle of the chains of command has the wherewithal to challenge policy. Only the people at the top can challenge policy. Often these are political appointees, and they're not going to give up their cushy jobs in government just because on a whim of conscience or ethics, even if they spent the time to actually review the literature.
Yep. It's like the same string, different banjo. I mean,
That's right.
with vaccines and the smart meters, it's with everything.
Yeah. That story was told to me by one of my colleagues in this. He's a dentist, and he has a master's of public health. And he said, when I was doing this MPH, this master's of public health, towards the end, it was about 5 weeks before I took my exam, I got into an argument with the professor on a scientific issue. I'm not sure if it was fluoridation or something else, but he said, the professor said to me, he says, it's not your job to look into the science of this issue. Your job is to carry out policy.
Oh.
Your job is, and my colleague who told me this said, if I hadn't been 5 weeks away from graduation, mm-hmm. I would have dropped out of that course right away. If my job was not to question the underpinning science of public health policy,
yeah.
then what am I doing here?
Well,
I mean, what's the purpose of this? And that's a pretty sad reflection of public health in general. You know, what we need here is education.
Mm-hmm.
Education, education, education. We need unbiased education at dental schools, unbiased education in med schools. We need doctors to learn something about nutrition. We need doctors to learn something about environmental toxicology. Education. I remember my Latin teacher giving me the most important lesson of my life when I was 12 years of age. He said, an educated person is someone who can entertain his or herself, and if he was doing it today, I'm sure he would say not with video games, entertain his or herself, entertain a friend, and entertain a new idea. And if you believe in that definition as I do, then it means there's a lot of people at university, there's a lot of people in prestigious bodies, professional bodies, etc., who are not educated because they've allowed their positions to become fossilized. They've lost the ability to entertain new ideas or look at the old ideas in a new way. They're fossilized, and as such, they're pretty useless to us. But on the other hand, there are people who have never stepped into a university or a dental school or a medical school who are highly educated because they have open minds, that they're willing to open the page. And our problem is not that we're wrong in the book. We may be, you know, there may be errors in there. Who knows? Our problem is not that people are getting through the book and disagreeing with us. Our problem is they're not opening the book. They're not willing, for psychological reasons, to actually turn over the first page mm-hmm. and begin to look at the information with an open mind. And we lose that open mind at our peril.
Well, apparently they don't open the book for fear that they may be wrong.
Well, most people do not want to set up this discordance between what they believe
right.
and the incoming information. If you sense for one moment that incoming information is going to involve you in a lot of work and a lot of angst,
sure.
you have a way of bringing the filters down pretty darn quickly.
Well, I hope that our listeners are intelligent and educated folks, and I believe they are because they listen to this program with an open mind and will take what it is that we're talking about today and evaluate it. And if they're having symptoms or not, maybe give that a try and try to reduce their exposure to fluoride, see if that helps with some of their symptoms. Your website is a huge resource. You have all these general rules, and I want to go through a couple. You just say the more processed a food is, the more fluoride it'll have. We get more fluoride from liquids than solids. Flavored beverages equal fluoridated water. Organic food has significantly less fluoride. Grape beverages equal fluoride pesticide. Processed meats equal more fluoride. So there's just so much information they can gather from your website, which is fluoridealert.org. And I really encourage folks to explore that and find out more.
And we shall also be outlining the steps that we are doing in our new campaign, which is Parents Against Fluoridation. Okay. This is our psychological response to their psychological grip that they have on the American public. The American public's walking around thinking that fluoridation is good for kids, good for teeth. But when anybody hears the name Parents Against Fluoridation, that's the discordance, isn't it?
Yes.
They believe, they've been told that fluoridation is good for kids, and then they hear Parents Against Fluoridation, it immediately triggers the question, why are parents against fluoridation? Mm-hmm. That brings you into dental fluorosis, IQ studies, level in mother's milk, etc. It's a parent's issue more than anything else. You want to protect your kids, and no professional should be forcing our kids to take this stuff, especially when they have very little understanding of the science.
The science.
I hope that people will consider forming a local chapter of Parents Against Fluoridation. We've got the science, but we need people to open that first page.
Excellent. I'm going to post some of that on our website if that's all right with you.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mentioned your website, but tell us again where we can go to get more information about you and what you do.
Yes, fluoridealert.org. They can find a lot of videotapes where I'm talking. I have another website which is more, our umbrella group is the American Environmental Health Studies Project. Don't bother to remember the name, but the website is AmericanHealthStudies.org, AmericanHealthStudies.org. You'll find much more about me there, about my work on waste management, which preceded fluoridation. I've been working on waste management for 28 years, just published a book on that called The Zero Waste Solution, Untrashing the Planet One Community at a Time. That's my first love, waste management, and that's taken me to 49 states in the U.S., 7 provinces in Canada, and 62 other countries. And it's good to remember that because when my wife asked me 18 years whether I would take on fluoridation, I didn't want to because I was so busy teaching chemistry full-time at a university and working on waste nearly every weekend and nearly every break and nearly every holiday. I didn't want a third issue, and I certainly didn't want a third issue that would stigmatize me as Looney Tunes amongst my academic colleagues. But when I started to read the stuff which I've shared this afternoon, not least of which is the very low level in mother's milk, I realized there was something seriously wrong with this practice. And nothing I've read in 18 years has changed my position.
Mm-hmm. Well, thankfully you took on that project so that you could help people today. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I thank you, Paul, for sharing your thoughts today, and I'm betting it's a topic most folks haven't given much thought to. So again, I encourage everyone to visit Paul's website, fluoridealert.org. It's also posted on our website as well. Thank you. And you know what? Keep us posted as things come up, new adventures, let us know and we'll share it with our listeners.
Absolutely, Pat. And the thing that's going for us, of course, is our independent media folks like yourself. We have, thank God, we need you. We need you with the press, the mainstream media, not doing its job on issues like this. We need you more and more. So I thank you for having me on your program.
I'd like for you to meet a fellow radio host whose program is all about keeping our planet safe. And you can listen to her weekly shows at speakuptalkradio.com.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I would love for you to become a part of my world. Mrs. Green's World is an engaged international community and a global movement of ideas and action made up of people who truly care about their own health and the health of this great planet of ours. In Mrs. Green's World, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our guests from all over the world will give you plenty of things to think about. Please visit my website at mrsgreensworld.com and become a part of our world.
She is a dear friend of mine with lots to share with you. She even has a book, and you can reach her by phone at 520-230-3977 or visit mrsgreensworld.com. Next is another wonderful friend who hosts a radio show about caregiving. She currently is the caretaker for her aging mom, and we connected when I, too, was caring for my mom.
Hi, this is Jana Panaritis, host of the AgeWise podcast, where we hear from the healthcare system's hidden workforce, the millions of family caregivers whose stories of devotion and courage will shock and inspire you. Join me as we shake up the conversation on care, and know you're not alone. Listen to a brand new episode every week at speakuptalkradio.com. To learn more about the show, visit the AgeWise website. That's AgeWYZ.com.
If you or someone you know is in the caregiver role, check out her website and purchase her book. Visit AgeWYZ.com, and that's spelled AgeWYZ, AgeWYZ.com, or give her a call, 800-590-2129. Well, there you have it. Lots to think about and plenty to speak up about. I hope that as you listen to this program each week, you make a conscious decision to speak up about those things that may seem small, may not affect you right now, but somewhere in your heart and in your mind, you sense are not right. We can make changes, but not through silence. So join me and be a voice of reason. It's only been within the past 10 years that I decided to remain silent no longer. It started when my mom was in the hospital back in 2008 for shoulder surgery and was then having a heart attack in the recovery room that went undiagnosed for 9 hours. It was then I realized that I had to make a move, and I became a patient advocate. I wrote the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide, and share what I now know at live speaking events. You don't have to wait for something bad to happen to begin advocating for change. It's never too soon, or too late for that matter, to speak up about things that speak to you. And as I mentioned my book and speaking events, let me remind you to get a copy of the book for yourself or as a gift for someone who may be in the hospital or a rehab facility or nursing home. What you don't know about our healthcare system can kill you, and I don't say that lightly. Visit the website speakupandstayalive.com to get your copy. It's only $20 and could very well be the best insurance you've ever owned. And while you're there, visit my speaking events link and then invite me to speak to your group, your club, business, association, church, or hospital. I can guarantee this. Your crowd will love it. Visit speakupandstayalive.com or call me to order the book and talk about making your next event a life-saving one. 440-725-5462. That is 440-725-5462. All right, we are out of time, but never out of topics. So be sure to come back next week. Same time, same place, but never the same information. Until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week. I am Pat Rulo, and I am the voice for informed choice.